This is Writers' Voices. I'm Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilburn. And we actually have a double show today. We have two authors. And, Mom, let's introduce the first one.
The first one is Brian David Johnson and Jan Eagleson, co-authors of MWD, Hell is Coming Home. And it's a very interesting book. Something about the authors. Brian is a journalist and entrepreneur. Jan is an independent filmmaker and writer. This is their first book for young adults. They both live in Boston, Massachusetts. Of course, the illustrator then is, I'm not sure.
We'll ask Brian to pronounce the illustrator's name. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Brian.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So, is this your first graphic novel?
Yeah, first graphic novel efforts. We actually initially wrote this as a screenplay, and Andalic Press liked the material and decided that it would be something they would really like to turn into a graphic novel. So we adapted our original screenplay and turned it into a graphic novel manuscript. And then the illustrators, Carl Stevens and Layla Malevsky, illustrated the book.
Well, I want to talk more about how that whole process worked. But first, let's talk a little bit about what this book is about. MWD, Hell is Coming Home. MWD, of course, stands for Military Working Dog. And this book follows a young woman's return from war and her bond with two dogs, one who saves her life in Iraq and another who helps her reclaim it at home. What inspired this book for you?
I mean, a number of things inspired it. Primarily, my co-author Jan Eagleson was the sort of the spark behind it. He has had a long career in film and in theater in Boston, and he had long delved into the subject of PTSD and soldiers coming home from war. But he really wanted to do a story about a woman coming home from war, and he is a dog lover and. Wanted to do a story about a female dog handler who comes home and what she would experience coming home from war and how she would react to her return, as well as understanding a little bit about what she faced while she was serving in the military. For myself, I was kind of in the right place at the right time. In some respects, my sister-in-law was a therapist, social worker who worked with returning veterans, particularly female veterans. And then I had another sister-in-law who was a dog trainer who worked with German shepherds and police dogs. So
that's how you were able to sort of able to research it without having been there yourself.
Yeah, definitely was able. Those were, I think, the foundation of the research. I did an extensive amount of research about both subjects, about what women face serving in the war, and in particular this war, the Operation Enduring Freedom, Operation Iraqi Freedom, and the conditions they served in, as well as a good deal of research about how post-traumatic stress disorder manifests itself, particularly in women.
Mm. When you said you set out to write this as a screenplay, have you done screenplays before?
Yes, I've been writing for as long as I can remember. Initially, I started my career script reader for 20th Century Fox about 20 years ago, and was writing scripts then as well. Then I made a turn into journalism and worked for the Associated Press and daily newspapers, business publications. I still work in the journalism space. I'm a publisher of several magazines in my day job, but it's always been a passion of mine doing these screenplays and short stories and now graphic novels.
Well, I'm curious how the screenplay came to the attention of a book publisher.
Yeah, I mean, so we had done the screenplay with the intention that we would create it, produce it ourselves, Jan would direct it, And we were kind of plodding along there, and he had actually had written another graphic novel about his father's experience in World War II, and he was actually pitching that to Candlewick Press, and they didn't feel that, the content was something they were interested in working with him on, and they had asked him sort of off the cuff, well, what else do you have? And he sort of said, well, I have this screenplay. I don't think you should that. And they said, well, maybe we would. What is it about? Told them. And much to our delight, they were very interested in that. And they called us in. We had a wonderful meeting, and they basically made us the offer right then and there. We said yes.
Wow, serendipity at work, huh?
That's the best kind.
Yeah.
Yeah. For sure.
Well, I think the illustrator in this case had a really good handle on people's emotions, because she could express them in their faces, you know, quite well, and their body language too, although of course they're not moving, but still there's a you know, she was able to do that. It was well done.
When it came to the, I mean, obviously in a graphic novel, the illustrations are a very important aspect, and it seems like, in some sense, like when you wrote the script for the graphic novel, like in a screenplay, you have directions for the action. Do you do that for this as well?
So, we focus very hard on how you show complicated internal struggles visually. So one of the things that we tried to do was really, instead of using exposition or telling people what the character was feeling, what we tried to do was really focus in on language and actions that would convey it more subtly, but also convey emotions very clearly. You know, it's all kind of, I think it was very much dictated in the dialogue how people would react. And when you write a screenplay, you write screen directions, but you can also be pretty colorful in the prose that you use to describe action. And I tend to write that way anyways. I use the screen action part to really try and write some descriptive prose about what the action and what is happening. Of course, it's all then left up to the skilled hands of an illustrator to convey that. And I would say that we gave them, in some respects, a very difficult job. A lot of our struggles that our character faces are somewhat internal, and you know, there really is no good guys and bad guys. She really is kind of both of those contained into one. So I think that they did a great job with a difficult task.
There's whole pages without dialogue, and what's the term for like each separate
panel?
Okay, so did you like give a detailed description of what you wanted for each panel?
Not in this case. What we did was we would write the scene almost as if it was a play or a screenplay or a manuscript. Uh-huh. And then it was up to the illustrator to separate each action into a panel. And it's interesting, you know, my mom, when she first read the book, she's like, oh, I really like it, but I don't... Did you do a lot of writing for it?
Yeah, there's not a lot of words in the book itself, is there?
Well, yeah, I mean, everything that she does, we wrote, right? I mean, so, you know, it's just all part of the process, and I think that's why it's an interesting art form, especially for a writer, because you do have to, you know, all of us want to go into a book reading and read our really flowery prose and the wonderful turns of phrases we can all use, but, you know, this is a medium that's really about story, more than about your skill as a writer. So it's more about your skill as a storyteller.
And, interesting.
That resonates with me, actually, a little bit more.
Well, it seems like with your background in screenwriting, both you and Jan, in background in film, it seems like this would be kind of a logical extension of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also, I think, an extension of my years as being a reporter. I have great people who taught me how to write for the news, and you know, you learn very quickly that there's just a big difference between showing and telling. And I remember my first journalism professor said, "Nobody runs fast; they just run." That always stuck with me. So use an economy of words. So that's better or worse, that's how I write now.
That's a good advice, actually.
That's great advice.
Yeah. Did the publisher assign the illustrators to you?
So typically how Candlewick Press does it is the manuscript comes first, and then once they've signed off on the manuscript, they've accepted your final draft, then they will go out and find the illustrators and contract with them. We had a little more input with the illustrations, just because it was such a long book, and we had a difficult time finding the right illustrators. Illustrators are in pretty high demand, and especially the very good ones. And you know, a graphic novel for an illustrator is a tremendous amount of work. It's at least 18 months, and that's if you're producing, you know, 2 pages a day.
Wow.
Basically. So, I mean, if you can imagine that level of detail, it's hard to find an illustrator who wants to put that much time in. And because, I mean, when you average it all out, it's not a heck of a lot of money when you...
Right.
Textualize it.
Now, you mentioned that there were 2 illustrators, Layla Milevsky and Carl Stevens. How did they work together?
So we have 2 distinct, I would say, sections of our book. One is our character Liz when she's in Iraq in the theater of war. And then we have Liz when she's at home. And what we felt would be a really useful narrative tool would be to have separate illustrators depict those 2 distinct points in her life. When a soldier's at war, their senses are heightened. Everything is crystal clear. You're always on very high alert, and so therefore we wanted to convey that through very crisp, detailed drawings. And then when you're home, when you come home from war, you are some people describe it as, you know, being in a fog, being wrapped in saran wrap. A lot of the soldiers struggle when they come home is to find themselves. And so we wanted somebody who could portray that in a little bit more of an ethereal way, maybe even a little more fuzzy way. So Layla illustrated that part. And it's a subtle difference, but it was something that we thought would be another way to kind of convey the difficulties of coming home from war, and how you do change, and you change both externally and internally.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Brian David Johnson, co-author of MWD, Hell is Coming Home, about a young woman's return from war and her bond with her dogs. Now, tell us a little bit more about how you worked with the illustrators. Like, did you get the week's panels to give feedback on, or, you know, how involved were you in the actual illustration process?
We were pretty involved. We would get a batch of pages every, you know, few months to take a look at. Sometimes we would get them. It happens in phases. So at first, we got rough sketches, which were basically stick figures and panels and with dialogue, so you could see roughly how they wanted to stage out the action. And we were asked for feedback then. Then we would receive art sporadically after that, pencil sketches and things like that. They would have questions as well in terms of continuity and saying, well, she says on page 20 this, but it looks like we have this illustrated. What do you think if we change this line? So it was a lot of detail work like that. So essentially what we try to do, which they do in animation all the time, is you go back to the writers to adapt a new line to match something that the illustrator did.
So it's really a back and forth, a very collaborative effort.
Yes, the whole process is very collaborative. I would say most collaboration happened between me and Jan as we were writing it. But, we had some time to talk to the illustrators to explain to them just any questions they might have about the character. We really were adamant that, Liz, it's all in Liz's face. These lines will work if her face expresses these things, and just pay particular attention to how you use those facial expressions. I think that they were both very good about that.
I'm curious, Brian, as to why you choose to write in collaboration. Now, with the illustration, I can see, obviously authors and illustrators are usually two different breeds and that you need collaboration on that. But in the writing process, what is it, that Jan brings that I'm assuming you think that the end product is better with both inputs. What is it that makes that true?
Well, I have always been a pretty collaborative person, but I think it does go back to writing is a very solitary process. And oftentimes when you're writing by yourself, if you spend a lot of time thinking of things and trying not to write yourself into a corner, which happens all the time, and you spend a whole lot of time coming up with solutions, trying not to paint yourself into a corner, as where if you work with a partner, and how we did it is that once we had come up with baseline ideas, I would go back and write, and then I would bring pages to Jan, and then Jan would read them, and then we would have long discussions about the scene and decide if the character was actually what the character was thinking. He would do a lot of what if she said this, what if she did that. And what he did particularly well was internalize and explain the internal dialogue of a character. And he would often push against my logical side with more of an emotional side. So he always wanted to have the character, what I call starting in the middle. He would want the character to do something very outrageous or very unpredictable. And I would always have to... we would argue the merits of that, and then a lot of times he would actually win that argument, and then I would go back and just make it work technically. And I did all the research, and he did a lot of the emotional research. So it worked very well in that sense. He's a dramatist. I'm a journalist, and I think that created a much more realistic portrayal of a person. I sometimes got too wrapped up in the idea that everything had to be substantiated by fact, and when you're doing a piece on people in the military and people who are real life, these are not real life people, but there's a lot of you don't want to make mistakes, and so I was always trying to make sure that everything we did was authentic and could happen in real life. So
well, I know that these
collaboration was really helpful.
These dogs are extremely valuable in the military, because especially the bomb-sniffing dogs, but all of them are. What happens to the dogs after their handlers leave, after they're mustered out? Then what happens? What becomes of the dog?
So dog handlers can adopt their dogs now. Dogs are extremely valuable to the military, and I think 2000, they were considered military equipment, and so handlers were not allowed to adopt their dogs.
The push to
when the dogs retire, to allow them to retire with their handlers as well.
I mean, the bond that's obviously between the dog and the handler, I think that's a really good rule that they've changed, that the handler can adopt the dog if they choose, because, you know, that handler depended on that dog for life saving, and then to have to walk away from him must have been really hard.
Yes, very emotionally taxing. And actually, in our original screenplay, that was really what the story was about, was that she had been separated from her dog and was fighting like hell to get the dog back.
Mm-hmm.
We actually had to make a change in the narrative when we converted it to a graphic novel for young adults. So we had to kind of eliminate that and pivot to a different type of story. But the military working dogs are some of the most valuable soldiers in the military, especially in these wars where bomb sniffing is critical.
Yep.
And sadly, you know, the Taliban in Afghanistan actually targets military working dogs now, because they are so...
Because they know how valuable they are. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and a soldier returning and going through the emotional difficulties, I would think that if they had been a handler, having the dog there would be very beneficial.
Absolutely, and I think animals in general are very beneficial to soldiers who are struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They use them as therapy a lot, and they are very effective. A dog is a great tool if you're if you sort of are feeling conflicted about the human species. Usually, you can find a lot of virtue in a dog. And there were some times when we were writing this one, I was like, well, it seems like some of the best men in this book is actually the dog. they're a great literary tool as well. You can imbue them with a whole lot of great characteristics.
So do you have another graphic novel in mind for the future?
Yes. I'm working on sort of several at the same time, all in various levels of completion. It's a field that I find really exciting. It can be tough, because it does take a very long time to get to have these see the world. So I'm experimenting with different styles, perhaps in a book with illustration rather than a straight up comic book,
mm-hmm.
a comic book type. But it's one of the most it's the only genre of fiction that sales have increased over the last few years. So,
you know, I was just going to ask about that, about where the kind of the graphic novel is in the pantheon of genres.
It's growing in terms of reputation. The book March by Congressman John Lewis was very widely recognized as an important piece of literature. I think people gravitate to the medium, and in terms of films, they tend to get made into movies a lot, because they're very easy to adapt, because they've already gone through that visual transformation. And it could be a very experimental medium, if you go to independent comic festivals, you can see all types of comic books and graphic novels that are out there, of all types of genres. It's not just superheroes. It's internal stories. It's everyday stories. So it's a very versatile medium.
Are you going to be focusing on this medium yourself going forward? Or you said you're still doing a lot of kind of traditional journalism as well?
Well, this is a great pursuit for me. I do have two children I have to raise and put through college, and so one book every 10 years. I don't think I'm going to be doing it.
How long did it take you to on this book? How long did you work on it?
Oh, in actuality, the writing only took a couple years, but to see the light of day, it took quite a few years for it to all come together. So we started the book in 2007, believe it or not. And
wow. So it really was 10 years.
Yeah, I don't think they don't.
Good.
I've been cursed with a diverse array of interests, skills, and I have a wonderful career as a media entrepreneur. I've started 4 publications and have done very well at that. So I'm always participating in writing in some aspect or another. But I continue to work to make graphic novels, and this is not going to be the end of that pursuit by any stretch.
Well, I'd like to tell our listeners that if you're not familiar with graphic novels, this is a very interesting place to start.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's been a long time since I read one, and I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's a serious subject, and it's a really kind of approachable way, mm-hmm. And a very accessible way to learn about it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. That's very kind.
Well, thank you very much for being with us today, Brian.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right. And we're going to take a short musical break here and be right back with Writer's Voices. We're back with Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our next guest will be joining us momentarily. We just spoke with Brian David Johnson, author of MWD, and here's our next guest.
Yeah. Here we are with our next guest.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Mark.
Hi, is this Monica?
Yes, it is. This is Monica and Caroline.
Monica, how are you?
Just great, and we are on the air.
Oh, wonderful. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, we're very excited to have you. And, Mom, why don't you introduce our guests to our listeners?
Okay, this book, My Lovely Wife in the Psych Ward, a memoir by Mark. How do you pronounce your last name, Mark?
It's pronounced Lukacs.
Lukacs, that's what I thought. Okay. And this was just published in May 2nd, 2017, so it's hot off the press. And it's a very moving book, and I don't know how. My first question is, how in the world did you remember all the details of this? Because it's amazing. Did you
I think that's a hard question. Well, logistically, it wasn't that hard to remember the details. The real challenge was actually to go and force myself to actually re-experience a lot of the details.
Yeah.
And Julia was hospitalized back in 2009 in a way that was really unexpected and really disrupted our lives. I didn't really know what to do. I was really panicked and kind of looking for answers. And I instinctively was updating my parents and her parents over email. And so we all had all sorts of questions and were doing different research and kind of passing along things. And so essentially I have a lot of the details of this by just pouring through old emails, because it was at that moment actually that I realized how much writing was a therapeutic way for me to process all that was going on, you know, because I'm not a trained writer. I'm a history teacher. And, I didn't really think that I would ever write a book, actually. but it was like just pages and pages of emails. I mean, I would sit down sometimes and write an email for 3 to 4 hours, you know, and it kind of helped me make sense of what was going on, because I had to make sense to my parents or to her parents. And but as I said at the beginning, going back and rereading those emails so that I could work on this book was pretty emotionally gut-wrenching, you know, to have to go and really try as deeply as I could to re-immerse myself in some very painful memories.
Wow.
Well, I think this book is it's something that anybody that's been through this would appreciate, but also people like myself that have never had to deal with this kind of thing, and we need to know about it. We really do. And
my hope is that someone reading this would learn about mental health for sure.
Yeah.
But I also think that anyone in any relationship has had a crisis, right? Like,
right.
Unfortunately, bad things happen to people we love.
Yeah.
And I think at the core what this book tries to look at is, how did Julie and I, how did we try to work together, to not let that bad thing ruin our relationship? And it was hard, and it was a real challenge and took a lot of work, but I think that that's really where I hope that readers of any background can connect to this book, you know?
Well, I think you had, in all of this turmoil, you had to focus on the fact that she loved you, even though she wasn't able to express that, and she seemed to be going in the opposite direction. But basically, that's what held you together.
Yeah, she was, her experience of mental illness, she's diagnosed with bipolar, and so she has psychotic episodes where she's delusional and, you know, believing things that aren't real.
Mm-hmm.
And then she has episodes of prolonged suicidal depression where she basically, you know, has a hard time making it through each day, basically like having a hard time finding a reason to stay alive. And at those moments, it is hard to not take it personally, to not wonder if she loves me or not, you know, like I got to be honest. If someone's saying, I don't even want to stay alive, and I'm like, well, we're married, you know, isn't that a reason to stay alive? But I just sort of had to accept that the love is absolutely there at the foundation. It was just that she was so consumed by the experience of her illness that she wasn't articulating that love, but she was still clearly connected to it. Because she has said subsequently that one of the main motivations for her to actually get out of bed each morning when she's depressed, or in times of stability like now, one of the main reasons to take her medication every day is because she wants to be healthy and engaged and just joyful around her family because of how much she loves her family, you know?
Yeah, because you have a son. And how old is he now?
He actually just turned 5 last week.
That's a great age.
Yeah, it is a great age. And Julia's been hospitalized 3 times. And after the first hospitalization, we kind of had this hope that she would, that it would be kind of a one-and-done thing.
There was a lot of
There was an optimistic diagnosis that this was sort of like what you might call a nervous breakdown, and that it was sort of over. And so we cautiously and with a lot of education and consultation decided to have a child, and everything was going great. But once Julia returned to work from her maternity leave, she had her second psychotic episode, and that was when Jonas was 5 months old. And then 2 years later, when he was 2.5 years old, she had her third hospitalization. So he's been alive for 2 of them. And that's a whole other intensely complicating and emotional aspect to things. You know, it's like the first episode was really, really trying on our relationship for the 2 of us. And then the second and third ones made, you know, our concept of family had expanded. And so how do we now just not have this mental illness exist, but also allow us to love as a couple? But now, how do we allow it to exist and still where we can love each other as a family?
Well, you know, Mark, I have so many questions for you, but I do want to give you an opportunity to read a little bit from the book.
Sure.
So let's do that now so that we don't run out of time when we're asking questions.
No problem.
And I want to tell our listeners a little bit more about you. You're a teacher. You're also a freelance writer that has been published in the New York Times, The Atlantic, and many other publications. You are currently the 9th grade dean at the Athenian School, where you also teach history, and that's in the San Francisco Bay Area. So what section would you like to read today?
So I'm going to open with a part from Julia's first hospitalization, where I was sort of introduced to the challenges of what it was going to be like to support her, right? What you just have to understand is, like, we knew nothing about mental illness. Julia had really very few symptoms that may have hinted that she was going to have a full-blown psychotic episode. So when I brought her to the hospital, I thought they were just going to give her a few pills and she'd be on her way.
Mm-hmm.
And instead they took her to the psych ward, where they admitted her on what is called a 5150. That's basically an involuntary hold of 72 hours. And during that 72 hours, she was offered medication, but she was allowed to refuse it. And after that 72 hours, the way it works is that there's a hearing where the doctor meets with a judge to recommend either the patient be discharged or else they are upgraded to what's called a 5250. And that's where the involuntary hold stretches out for 14 days, and a patient is allowed to be forced medication if they refuse it. And so this excerpt is when I showed up. I had requested to go to the hearing because I was really worried, and in the 3 days that since we had brought her there, Julia wasn't taking her medication, and she was looking actually worse by the day. And I wanted to go and, you know, sort of advocate that Julia needed the care, and so she needed to stay in the hospital. There's one last technicality to be aware of, is that to protect patients' rights, a patient actually has to sign off on who the hospital can communicate with. And when we brought her there, Julia's mom was with us, and they had ridden the ambulance together, and so Julia signed off for her mom. But I was following in the car behind, and I didn't show up till like 15 minutes after. And so when I got there, Julia had already been processed, and I was not signed off as someone they could speak with. So here I am, 3 days into my wife's hospitalization, to show up to a hearing where technically the hospital isn't allowed to even be able to talk to me. On the 3rd day, the hospital was going to have a hearing where the doctor presented his case to the judge to see if Julia's 5150 should be upgraded to a 5250. I asked if I could attend, and they said sure. I still wasn't technically allowed to speak with any of the nurses, but I was allowed to go to the hearing. It was going to be on Thursday at 10 a.m., almost exactly 72 hours after we had brought Julia to the ER. For some reason, I thought I needed to dress up for the hearing, so I wore a shirt and tie and arrived at 9:30. I buzzed the ringer to the nurse's station. "Can I help you with something?" she asked, poking her head through the door. "It's not visiting hours until the evening." "Oh, I'm not here to visit," I said. "I'm here for Julia Lukacs' hearing. I was told it was going to be at 10 a.m. Oh, right. Yeah, actually, that already happened. The judge was running early, so they finished about a half an hour ago.
Oh.
But they said 10, and I'm 30 minutes early. I was in disbelief. Well, it's done already. You can come back tonight to visit. Wait, I'm not leaving yet. I grabbed onto the door handle that was on my side of the room so the nurse couldn't close the door on me. Can I at least find out what happened at the hearing? I mean, come on. Okay, wait a minute. She closed the door and went back to the nurse's station. I sat in the waiting room, fuming with frustration at the bureaucracy of the mental health system, picking at my stuffy shirt and tie. I had wanted to be there. My mother and I both adamantly agreed that Julia was looking worse than when we brought her here, so there was no way she should be coming home, but what if the doctor didn't agree? After a few minutes of shuffling through paperwork and speaking on the phone, the nurse at the station came back into the waiting room and sat in the chair next to me. The judge signed off on the doctor's request, she said. Julia has been upgraded to a 5250. So she has to be here another 14 days, I asked? Yeah, kind of. If she's ready to come home sooner, then of course she'll come home earlier. But what if she's not better after 14 days? Then we do another hearing with another possible extension. A heavy silence followed as I thought about how long 2 weeks were. So now this means that Julia can't refuse her medication, right? I asked. Right, the nurse said. So did she get her medication, I pressed? I'm not supposed to get into the details since Julia still hasn't signed off for you to speak directly with us. Oh, come on, please, I begged her. Give me a break. I came out here for a hearing. I got here early and I still missed it. The least I can get is a little update. The nurse looked at me uncomfortably. She got her medicine this morning right after the hearing, she said quietly. Did she take the medication voluntarily, I asked. I can't tell you that, she said timidly. I shouldn't have even told you that she had medicine. Please, this is a nightmare. Just please work with me here, I said, exasperated. Can you at least tell me if she took the pills by herself? She did not take the pills by herself. Got her medication. I knew what that meant. Closed my eyes and imagined three nurses walking into Julia's room, offering her pills, knowing she would refuse them, and them holding her down as they rolled up her hospital gown to expose her thigh for an injection. This is what a 5250 meant, and I had showed up early in a shirt and tie to argue that Julia needed the 5250. But the image of it, the nurses pressing on her body, Julia tensed and yelling and resisting whatever way she could, and then injecting her anyway, and knowing with certainty that it had happened, felt so tragic that it eclipsed the anger that had been boiling over. So that's that, I said quietly, breathing deeply to hold in the tears. Can I go see her? I'm sorry, but it's not visiting hours. The nurse gently patted my hand and then went back to work. I sagged into the already sagging chairs, completely overwhelmed by the layers of emotions that buried me into the chair. Grief, fear, rage, more grief. In the perverse dystopia of the psych world, this was progress.
Thank you.
But that is kind of how I learned what it's like to love someone who has a psychotic break, you know, that I had to show up and advocate for treatment that when you actually realize what it looks like, feels so invasive and so demeaning, but also so important, you know?
Yeah.
And so I chose that because I think it highlights the profound difficulties of being a caregiver.
The frustration, frustration of it.
You don't have enough information. No one's really telling you stuff. You just kind of have to figure it out and ask a lot of questions and refuse to take no for an answer.
And you feel absolutely powerless because, you know.
Now, that was the theme of the entire first episode. I had this, you know, Julian and I grew up in a pretty charmed life, and I felt sort of in control of my life. And over again, I was clearly told that mental illness doesn't care how much control I have, that I actually had very little control, and that what's going to happen is what's going to happen. And
yeah.
I did my best to be gentle and patient and loving, but I thought those would fix things. And I just think that they made the experience a little less unpleasant, but they certainly couldn't fix them.
And you had to, take care of yourself. And after your son was born, you had to take care of him. And
yeah, that became another challenge. So the first, I think, taking care of myself was sort of the first lesson. But then the twin challenge of raising what was at first a 5-month-old. For Julia's second hospitalization, she was actually put in a hospital that was an hour away from the house. Mm-hmm. To go visit her was like a 4-hour extravaganza that I was doing every day. And, you know, do you want to drag the kid down there? And he's not even really allowed in the hospital, so what do you do? And all these logistics, you know. And then, but beyond just the logistics, it's like the emotional space to love someone who is in a psychotic episode is so different than the emotional space to raise an infant, right? Well, in an infant, you just want to be unconditional love and happiness and joy so that they just feel like this is a beautiful world we're living in. And for Julia, I mean, I never know what I would never know what I was going to get when I'd show up. Mm-hmm. Maybe she'd be really agitated. Maybe she'd be really, like, sedate and not really want to say anything. Sometimes she'd be really sweet and affectionate. Sometimes she'd be really hostile. And so it's like you don't know how you just kind of walk in and have to respond in the moment and then come back and then try to turn on the sweetness for your child, you know? So it was tough. I'm not going to lie. I actually think that second hospitalization was probably the stretch at which I felt the most helpless and, like, I didn't know if I could actually support both of them at once. And, you know, I wasn't entirely solo. We live in California, but my parents at the time were living in Japan.
Yeah.
And Julia's from Italy, so her parents were in Italy. So, like,
your support
family was
system.
Far.
Yeah, your
but,
support. Yeah.
Thankfully, family was still able to come and help. So, like, during the hospital, if I would go visit Julia, either my mom or my mother-in-law was there staying with us to watch Jonas, our son. And so that certainly helped, you know, but it's still, it's like quite a toll, you know, it's definitely quite a toll to take. Mm.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Mark Lukacs, the author of My Lovely Wife in the Psych Ward, a memoir. You know, you talked at the beginning about how difficult it was to really delve in and relive this as you were writing the book.
Yeah.
But also, how was it for Julia?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, it was hard. It was definitely hard for the two of us. So, like, the original reason I wrote this book, actually, I decided I wanted to write after her first episode because our experiences of that episode were so different. When Julia got better and was, like, sort of back to normal living, she just wanted to have fun. You know, she was like, this is the worst year of my life. I just want to relax, enjoy, live life, feel gratified, which is totally understandable, you know? But for me, I had been bottling up and ignoring all of these feelings that I could not really share with her because she was so fragile. And so when she got better, I kind of needed to get it all out, you know?
Yeah.
And that was really hard for us to do that. We would get in a lot of fights. She was really, she just didn't get it. She's like, dude, like, things are better. Get over it. You know, like, what's the problem? And I'm like, you don't understand how hard it was to support you with such little reciprocation. You know, I'm not mad at you. I'm not blaming you. But, like, you need to acknowledge that this has been a one-way street for a while. And so, like, we even tried marriage counseling and everything. But honestly, it was writing because I could sort of go and express it in a way that was really really thoughtful and really processed, and then she would read it, come back and have questions for me, and that would sort of spark our discussion. And that, the writing about this, actually became a way for us to appreciate the differences of each other's experience, but also acknowledge how much we needed to treat this like a shared illness, right? Like, we needed to approach this together. It wasn't that Julia could say that it was harder for me because I was in the hospital, or I could say it was harder for me because I basically had to manage not just my life, but your life. But instead, it's like we both, it's hard for both of us. And so mm-hmm. That's how we just experience it differently. So that was honestly why the book came about. It was like a really personal project to reconnect with Julia. And in that regard, I'm like I feel like it was a huge success because it really helped us to reunite. We decided to go public with it because we believe that there's potential that this book can help other people. You know, that the that exploration of mental illness as a family experience as compared to an individual experience.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly was looking for narratives like that when Julie was hospitalized and not finding them. And so my hope has been that if I can write about this, maybe some readers out there might just be able to find a little bit of hope or guidance along the way. And I have to say, like, yeah, we continued to, it was still tough, like it was emotional, and we sometimes would disagree about what we wanted in the book or what we didn't want in the book, but in the end, you know, we've done a couple book readings, Julia comes to all of them, and we always do a Q&A with the audience that Julia participates in, and it's been unbelievable to see how empowered she is. That she stands there with so much pride and so much wisdom. I feel like the way that this book has transformed her makes me, like, I've fallen even more in love and have grown even more admiration for her, for the courage she had, not just to go through these challenging experiences, but to share them so that others can learn from them. It's really amazing.
Well, you know, mental illness is something, as you know, you well know, that is sort of, it's hard to talk about, and it's hard to share There's an element of blame of the person suffering from mental illness world at large.
If you fall out of a tree and break your arm, people don't sit there and micro-analyze.
Yeah, like, well, you shouldn't have been.
They just say you broke your arm.
Yeah.
But, like, if someone is depressed or has a psychotic break or any of these other things, it's like it's an invitation for people to say, well, what's wrong there? And what happened here? And whose fault is this?
Yeah,
exactly.
It's tough, you know?
And this is Mental Health Awareness Month, I understand. So it's a
And I actually think that we still sometimes get questions about, like, why do we think this happened to Julie? And, like, I don't think it's just a simple matter of brain chemistry. I think that it's really multi-layered. But to be honest with you, I've made peace that I probably, like, the human brain is too complicated for me to understand why the experience is this. It's just part of who she is, you know, and I love her regardless, and she's an amazing woman and incredibly accomplished through it, and so it's like, I don't want to just sit there and, you know, spin my brain trying to understand the why, because I don't even know what that gets us anyway, you know?
Now, well, I don't think the medical community really understands either, do they?
And you know what? Thankfully, there's, like, continuing research, but the human brain is so much more complicated than any other organ.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't, this again goes back to, like, me not understanding mental illness when Julia got sick, because I thought it would be like a broken arm. This is what happened. Here's our diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Here's our treatment.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, it's like, this is what we think is happening. This is one of the 30 possible things we could do based on that.
Oh.
To keep trying them until the right one sticks. You know?
Oh,
well,
boy.
And I think why people are so eager to find the cause is because otherwise we have to acknowledge the fact that it could happen to anyone.
Yeah, I think that's another great point too, right? Is that if you can assign, like, blame even, and you can feel that you're not going to be impacted this way, right?
Right.
But, I mean, Julia, she was, like, one truly almost had a perfect GPA in high school and college, had amazing internships, jobs. Everyone she's worked with has always raved about her as far as an incredibly, like, just so good at what she does. She's beautiful. She's warm. I mean, just a really awesome person, and she got struck with bipolar, you know? It's like, yeah, so you're right. It does feel like it can happen anyway. I think that's a really good point.
We only have a couple of minutes, but I briefly wanted to ask you, you deal with the subject of anti-psychiatry a little bit in the book. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think that the original view of psychiatry that I fell back onto was the medical model, right? Which is like, this is about brain chemistry, and we're going to give you these pills, which fix the brain chemistry, and things are going to be okay. Anti-psychiatry is a movement that is really questions that premise. It even questions the premise that some of these experiences like psychosis or depression are bad things that need to be fixed, but are instead maybe a part of living that can even be a good thing, you know, like that people gain insights through psychosis that they otherwise would not have in a quote-unquote normal perspective. Mm-hmm. I have a friend who is a really dear friend of mine, and he kind of introduced me to some of the ideas of anti-psychiatry during Julia's second episode. And at the time, I was sort of in the throes of it, and it was really hard for me to process this because anti-psychiatry, as the name implies, is directly confrontational to psychiatry. And so there is a lot of criticism of, for example, forced injections, medication at large, right? Mm-hmm. And so it was really hard for me to think through these ideas when I was in the thick of it. But afterwards, I realized there's some really powerful insight in it, especially anti-psychiatry. I think what they clued me into the most is that mental illness, it's so much about the power dynamic, right? The doctor's completely in charge. The patient feels like they have little to no say because they're in maybe an altered state, and so their perspective isn't even really, really, really being listened to. It's more just being like, uh-huh, yeah, whatever, you're psychotic, so we're going to fix you, you know? And I think that where I currently stand is like kind of moving on the spectrum from day to day, but it's really become more like I understand why the medicine can be super helpful for people, but I also understand that when you treat someone, you need to give them dignity. You need to have them feel a sense of autonomy, because otherwise there's going to be a lot of built-up resentment, which could
right.
come into fruition later in some really ugly ways.
And Mark, it seems like you really found a good balance there between psychiatry and empowerment.
Yeah, I think
it works
for us,
anti-psychiatry,
right? Try to have a team approach. We want her voice to be heard. We want my voice to be heard. We recognize that medicine works for her, but truth is, it's working for us now. And I think the biggest thing is just recognizing that, like, how her illness continues to unfold over the rest of our lives, being open to an evolving idea of how we want to treat it, you know? It's just like, we just can't be rigid. We have to be flexible because we don't know what it might look like and what our lives might look like when it hits.
That is true. And Mark, thanks so much for being with us today. We are out of
time.
You're
welcome.
And Caroline, I know you have some closing words.
Yes, and I wanted Mark to hear this because it applies to him. If you're someone people count on, particularly in difficult moments, that's a sign of having lived a life honorably.
And thank you so much for listening, tuning in to Writers' Voices today. See you next week. You can hear the rebroadcast Monday morning at 8 a.m. if you're listening to us on Friday. Stay tuned now for Planet Erstwhile with James Moore.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.